here. It was forever weakened. So much so that the company would form a joint venture and ultimately be acquired by Sony just to survive. Among the hottest topics in all of business today is risk management. Risks are found in situations with uncertain outcomes. And given the rate of change occurring in the world today, our businesses are laden with uncertainty. It's enough to keep you up at night. And that's precisely why I want to address risk management in this lecture. The media are literally full of examples every day of companies that fail to take something into consideration, something for which they're being held accountable, something that goes wrong and probably seriously wrong on their watch. A famous study was conducted in the field of operations management by professors Kevin Hendricks of Wilfrid Laurier University and Vinod Singhal of Georgia Tech. The study looked at large publicly traded companies between 1989 and 2000 and the hit their stocks took when a supply chain disruption was reported in their businesses, something that delayed production or delivery. They found that on average, the typical firm's stock price dropped by just over 10% when the world learned of a bad day in the company's business or supply chain. Can you imagine running a business with a long history, maybe a heritage dating back 100 years, and having 10% of the company's value washed away in just a few hours because you're having a bad day? I would argue that the impact could be far greater today in light of the usage and consumption of social media, with tens of thousands of blogs ready to report on any misstep in your business. Information flows much faster and further today than ever before. The world can learn about your bad day sooner and in a way that newspapers never could imagine. Remember the BP Deepwater Horizon oil leak off the east coast of Louisiana in 2010? With live cameras directed on the Seaford Gusher, we could literally watch BP's image ebb in real time with every second of gushing oil. It could also be argued that the ramifications of a bad day could be greater for smaller businesses that likely would not have the resources to ride out a rough patch, or the ability to make demands on suppliers or even customers for help in weathering such a storm. So how can you be on the winning side of such a perilous situation, or at least dampen the effects of a potentially devastating circumstance? The first step is to conduct a 360-degree scan of your organization and its environment. In conducting these 360-degree surveys of the business, strategists often use what's known as a SWOT analysis, where S stands for strengths, W for weaknesses, O for opportunities, and T for threats. Strengths and weaknesses are assessments of the internal condition of the organization. Meanwhile, the O and T, opportunities and threats, are external to the company. Weaknesses represent the internal risk imposed on the business. Throughout this course, we've explored different sources of weaknesses in companies, ranging from departmental conflict, an inattentiveness to mission, and inability to change and improve. No doubt, change is a difficult feat to pull off. Most people are not wired to welcome change. Dr. Edward Miller, Dean of the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University, once observed of heart disease patients. He said, "If you look at people after coronary artery bypass grafting, 2 years later, 90% of them have not changed their lifestyles. Even though they know that they have a very bad disease and they know that they should change their lifestyle, for whatever reason, they can't." Wow. Even in true life or death circumstances, people have difficulty with change. Yet, as former General Electric CEO Jack Welch points out, if the rate of change outside your organization exceeds the rate of change inside, the end is near. Wow. So there's a predicament that we must overcome in our organizations to somehow embrace change. Closely related to reluctance to change is complacency, and it happens to the best of us. Toyota, long admired for its production prowess and cited several times in this course for that very reason, succumbed to complacency at a time when it had just ascended to become the world's largest auto company. It made big news in 2009 when Toyota surpassed General Motors in worldwide sales. GM had held the sales crown for 77 years. Later that year, however, Toyota faced one of the most difficult chapters of its storied existence when it issued not one, but two recalls for unintended acceleration problems. While debated, the focus of the recall investigations centered on two possible problems: out-of-place floor mats and sticking accelerator pedals. Toyota, with its reputation for quality, faced government censure in its home market of Japan and massive fines issued by the U.S. government in the automaker's largest market. The company's stock took a 20% hit in the weeks following the first reports of the problem, writing down the company's value by an estimated $35 billion. But perhaps worst of all, though, was the dark shadow of doubt cast over the company and its products for a time. It took a few years to regain the confidence of customers and shareholders. These missteps can be extremely costly, and it can take a long time to resurrect a company's reputation. Internal weaknesses can be among the most difficult to identify and measure. Sometimes symptoms persist for a long time before they result in noticeable problems that get called out. To aid in this recognition of symptoms before they become big problems, many companies today employ a tool called Failure Mode and Effects Analysis, known by the acronym FMEA, and sometimes pronounced FMEA. Failure Mode and Effects Analysis helps to identify and prioritize risk of all kinds. FMEA was developed in the 1950s by reliability engineers in military supply companies. NASA is perhaps the best-known organization to have used the tool, or different variations of it, especially throughout the years of manned spaceflight programs. Failure mode and effects analysis has gained widespread adoption in recent years by companies embracing operational excellence methods like Lean and Six Sigma. But what is a failure mode? In simple terms, it's anything that could go wrong in your business, something that falls short of expectations or performance standards. A failure effect, then, is an outcome or consequence of the failure mode. FMEA provides a scoring system for prioritizing the risk factors that call for the greatest attention. This is believed to be more objective than simply pointing to problems that need to be addressed. Since there's not enough time and money to address all possible problems, we need to prioritize them. The first step in the FMEA process is to brainstorm all the possible failure modes that you might experience. Each failure mode is then evaluated on three attributes. First, the probability of occurrence. Second, the severity of the occurrence. And third, our ability to detect its occurrence. As the creation of reliability engineers, failure modes and effects analysis and its scoring system involve some pretty intricate language, and you're free to use it if you like. I find, however, that a simple subjective scoring system when evaluating the three attributes is sufficient. I like to use a simple 1 to 10 for each criterion. A risk priority number, or RPN, is the composite of the three scores. So let's say that something rates 10 across the board. That means it's highly probable, perhaps inevitable, is extremely severe when it does occur, perhaps resulting in fatalities, and is very difficult to detect at the time of occurrence. That multiplies out to 10 times 10 times 10, or 1,000. That would be a very rare risk priority number. But the point is that RPNs will range between 1 and 1,000. Our objective is not to achieve 100% accuracy in this assessment, but to shine a light on the risk factors that are or should be keeping us up at night. So FAMEA can be a helpful tool for identifying internal vulnerabilities that call for our attention. There are other steps that can be taken within the four walls of your organization to make it more agile and resilient. You can implement information technologies that make you aware of internal and external circumstances calling for your attention. You should also establish a high level of communication across departments and functions to facilitate information sharing. You can also cross-train your employees to take on different roles and tasks so they're aware of each other's priorities and they can fill in for each other in a case of crisis. These steps can elevate your company's ability to sense and respond to challenges. We'll now turn our attention to the external risk that companies face. The Ericsson-Nokia case study points to a common source of risk, the supply chain. As you recall, the supply chain is the network of companies that work together to provide a good or service for the end-use market. Virtually every company exists within and depends on a network of companies to create and deliver value in the market. We all exist within this ecosystem of supply chains. Although outsourcing is common in many industries today, we've seen that it's not an effective strategy for pushing off risk, especially if it's your brand on the product or you sell directly to end customers. You will be held accountable. If not in the judicial system, in the court of public opinion, for any egregious act perpetrated in the provision of a product. Just ask toy maker Mattel, which had to explain why lead paint was used in the production of children's toys when a subcontractor to Mattel's contract manufacturer failed to use the certified paint. Another example is in the North American pet food brands that had to answer for the poisoning of thousands of cats and dogs when a Chinese supplier of vegetable protein shipped tons of melamine-contaminated wheat gluten to the pet food makers in 2007. The contamination is said to have resulted in kidney failure among several thousand pets that consume the tainted foods and required more than 5,300 food products to be removed from the shelves that year. So the risks are aplenty. And when you consider the supply chain network in which your organization resides, when assessing opportunities and threats in light of this network orientation, I recommend mapping the network on a whiteboard, on paper, or with drawing software, just as you do to analyze your company's internal processes. Like any kind of map, we'll try to keep it simple, at least in the first pass, allowing for greater detail in later iterations. The first pass of the supply chain map is dedicated to identifying who makes up your supply chain. If you're using a whiteboard, write your organization's name in the middle of your whiteboard. Focus on a single product or service offered by your organization. Then ask, who provides material inputs that support this offering? These are your immediate or tier one suppliers. Write the names of these suppliers to the left of your organization's name. Where you might have many different suppliers of a given input, group them together. Alternatively, you might have one supplier that provides many different inputs. Our goal in this first pass map is to try to explain the most with the least, not to burden ourselves with unnecessary detail at this stage. Once you have a satisfactory diagram of your tier one suppliers, then do the same thing for your customers. Who is it that buys this product or service from you? These are your tier one customers. Place each customer or group of customers to the right of your organization on the board. I recommend that you list your really important customers individually. Next, see if you can identify the suppliers who support your tier one suppliers. These are your tier two suppliers, and they may be difficult to identify unless they brand their components or products, and these brands are considered important for your business. I expect this listing of tier two suppliers to be much more difficult since you don't tend to deal directly with these suppliers. Where you can identify them, list them. Place them on the left of your tier one suppliers, connecting them to the appropriate tier ones that they serve. For those that you cannot identify, try to at least list the ingredient, component, or input that feeds your suppliers at the tier one level. Now, list your customers' customers. Those are your tier two customers. Similar to tier two suppliers, these companies are likely to be more difficult to identify, especially if they're mass market consumers at the tier two level. Place tier two customers on your map or groups of tier two customers to the right of your tier one customers on your map. Once you have the map set out before you, step back and take a look at what's there. Who are your most critical suppliers and most valuable customers? Where are you most dependent in your relationships, or even overly dependent? You might find yourself overly dependent on one or a few key customers. This is often the case with companies that sell to and through Walmart. As we've seen, it's not at all uncommon for Walmart to represent somewhere between 15 and 40% of the total sales of a consumer goods company. If one customer represents, say, more than 20 to 25% of your sales, that's a pretty ominous sign. And my message to those of you in that situation is to diversify your customer portfolio. You want to be able to direct your capacity toward the best paying opportunities, but don't be overly dependent on one or a few key customers. It puts you in a very weak bargaining position when the dependence is so one-sided. At a minimum, you want to engender a level of codependency in these arrangements. Likewise, you may be overly dependent on one or more suppliers. In the Ericsson case, Ericsson was overly dependent on Philips and not sufficiently prepared to enlist replacement suppliers for the semiconductor chips it needed. Nokia, on the other hand, had built some redundancy that they could call on in the event of crisis into their supply chain. And that's exactly what they did. So ask yourself, who could shut down my business by failing to deliver? It's important to recognize that you may be overly dependent not just on an individual supplier, but on an individual ingredient that goes into your products, or you might be overly dependent on a few select locations. Consider the case of rare earth minerals. These are metals that are mined, processed, and used extensively in advanced consumer and industrial technologies. My guess is that the device you're using to watch or listen to this lecture is loaded with rare earth minerals. Though their name implies that they're rare, they're actually all around us today. But they're difficult to extract and rather dirty and costly to process. Environmental regulations here in the U.S. have made it economically unviable to mine these materials here. As a result, the world has become dependent on suppliers of these materials in China, where environmental laws are not so, well, onerous, or at least strictly enforced. It's estimated that even though the nation of China is endowed with about half of the world's natural supply of these rare earth minerals, Chinese companies supply about 96% of the world market. This realization puts manufacturers of technological products ill at ease. Do they want to be so dependent on one nation for supply? This can be especially problematic when a foreign government elects to impose tariffs and quotas, dramatically altering the availability and price of supply, which happens from time to time. Alert companies are determined to engineer these materials out of their products. Clearly, this calls for a cross-functional team to figure out how a different material might serve the purpose of the original ingredient. Another instance calling for global awareness of the reach of supply chains comes from regulatory requirements. In the summer of 2010, the federal government passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, known as Dodd-Frank for short. The legislation was primarily focused on putting an end to the financial gimmickry that sent our economy into a tailspin between 2007 and 2009. But it also contained one provision, Title 15, that requires companies to disclose any use of so-called conflict minerals. These are minerals like gold, tin, and tungsten, sourced from any one of 10 different nations of Central Africa. The sales of these valuable minerals are believed to fund armed forces committing atrocities and human rights abuses in the war-torn nation of the Democratic Republic of Congo. This means that you must report the use of any such materials to the Securities and Exchange Commission and justify their use or be subject to punitive measures. You also need to be aware of state laws affecting your supply chain, such as the California Transparency and Supply Chains Act of 2010. That act requires large retailers and manufacturers doing business in California to disclose their efforts to eradicate slavery and human trafficking from their direct supply chains for all the goods they offer for sale. So you must verify that your supply chains are free from such egregious activities, even in far-off lands. And don't even think about selling a food product in Europe with genetically modified organisms, GMOs, which are oh so common here in the U.S. More laws of these kinds calling for traceability and supply are expected in the future. In essence, they will require a mapping of supply chains all the way back to the original source of material at the elemental level. Examining your downstream relationships with multiple customer tiers can be equally enlightening. This is especially true if your products require tight controls of some kind, like food items that require strict quality or temperature controls. You might also want to consider what stores sell your products and how that can affect your product's image. Really valuable merchandise like Rolex watches shouldn't be sold at discount outlets or convenience stores, right? Rolex is a tightly controlled brand in light of its prestigious image, and it only sells its products through licensed jewelers. Where you have difficulty mapping critical supplies and customers, it illuminates a need for understanding and possibly greater controls. In the dozens of supply chain maps that my students have created on behalf of companies, every single one has presented aha moments, situations that the company was not aware or wasn't managing actively, situations that presented some level of vulnerability. One finding that is quite common in supply chain mapping is the revelation of common sources of supply at the Tier 2 level. Let me explain. In an effort to avoid overdependence at the Tier 1 level, you might buy from two or more Tier 1 providers of the same input. Yet the supply chain, when mapped beyond Tier 1, might show that your Tier 1 suppliers are buying from the same supplier at Tier 2. Therefore, if disruption occurs at this Tier 2 supplier, all your Tier 1 suppliers of this item could be paralyzed, making you as vulnerable as if you had only had one Tier 1 supplier. This circumstance is only uncovered if you map your supply chain beyond the Tier 1 level. Along with mapping your supply chain, it's a good idea to do a 360-degree scan of your environment in order to identify risk factors other than those residing with suppliers and customers. These include the risk that competitors can present, or risk found in the markets and economies in which you operate, or the risk that social change or government actions can introduce. The failure mode and effects analysis, FAMEA tool, introduced earlier, can be helpful in conducting this external assessment and prioritization of risk too. By brainstorming around these risks, you can identify an incredibly diverse array of risk, everything from everyday occurrences to the extremely rare. The military offers language that is helpful here. It speaks of known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns. These terms were made famous by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and embraced by many business risk analysts today. Known knowns are events that have some precedent and might even be explained or predicted. Known unknowns are those events that have been identified but happen rarely and hence have little supporting data. Unknown unknowns, or black swan events, as they're sometimes called, are those that can only be imagined, having no recorded history. Again, what I'm prescribing is a brainstorming activity, where events, common or not, can be brought forward. In one project, a company that I was working with enlisted two of its major suppliers, one at Tier 1 and the other at Tier 2, to participate in a brainstorming session. Among the three companies, we identified 140 different risk factors that could influence how the companies did business together. As indicated previously, some of the events were mundane, and others seemed like they were lifted from the latest spy novel. Some carried minor impacts, and others, if realized, could prove catastrophic to one or more of the businesses, ultimately affecting the service offered to the end customer of the supply chain. Out of the analysis, the companies prioritized the factors that called for immediate attention. And the strategic response was pretty dramatic, calling for one of the suppliers to acquire another company in order to secure intellectual property that the supply chain partners deemed critical to their mutual success. When you brainstorm about your own company's risk, you may discover that some of them are interdependent. You might find, for instance, that by eliminating one risk, you elevate or introduce another. One risk common to all businesses is the risk of disappointing customers by stocking out of product, not having something available when and where customers want it. One way to address this risk is to hold large quantities of inventory. Yet inventory comes with a cost. So by reducing one risk, we elevate another. Of course, we want to eliminate risk when possible. However, the name of the game in risk management is usually to offset an unacceptable risk with a more acceptable one. It's like paying an insurance premium. You're willing to pay a small amount on a regular basis to offset a catastrophe if something bad were to happen. Once you've got a strategy for embracing challenges in place, try to form strategic relations with your most critical suppliers and prized customers, and be a good partner to those suppliers and customers. That way, you'll have each other's back when times get tough. And those kinds of connections will make it very difficult for competitors to emulate your success in good times and bad. It's like having a faithful group of friends when dealing with a personal crisis. You want your best customers and suppliers to stand with you in the face of challenges. Identifying and managing risk is vital to building agile, resilient businesses. But to tell you the truth, so are all of the elements of business operations. Competition in business is so fierce today that you can't afford to have any slack or complacency in the way your company does things. And because operations is responsible for much of the value creation found in any business, you need to take every opportunity to maximize that value and minimize expense. Every business is different, but the essential tools and technology for achieving operational excellence work in just about any setting. And they aren't a mystery anymore. The ones we've explored are the same as those being taught in the finest business schools. You need to find the most efficient way to create the product or offer the service that you want to provide to your customers. You need to plan your company's overall strategy with the input of both the supply and demand sides of the organization. You need to figure out the optimal size and method for replenishing your inventory. You need to determine who your profitable customers are and ensure their loyalty. You need to eliminate waste from your processes in pursuit of perfection to yield the greatest possible value. You need to measure your operational performance to improve it without losing time measuring the wrong things. You need to strengthen your supply chain, making your most important suppliers and customers part of your team. And yes, you need to minimize risk and create contingency plans to reduce vulnerabilities. If you can do those things, you and any company you run or work for will be equipped for a very bright future. I wish you every success.
The financial information provided in these lectures is for informational purposes only and not for the purpose of providing specific financial advice. You should contact a financial advisor to obtain specific financial advice. These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. These lectures are titled Critical Business Skills, Finance and Accounting. Your lecturer is Eric Sussman. Mr. Sussman is a senior lecturer in accounting and real estate at the University of California, Los Angeles, Anderson School of Management. He received his MBA from Stanford University with honors. Professor Sussman has received 13 Teaching Excellence Awards voted on by Anderson's MBA students, as well as the Citibank Teaching Award and the Nydorf Decade Teaching Award, both voted on by a committee of faculty members. He also has consulted for large and small firms nationally and globally, and is a frequent lecturer on varied topics in financial, accounting, and corporate reporting. This lecture is titled Accounting and Finance, Decision-Making Tools.
2008 was the year most investors would like to forget. Bear Stearns, a large investment bank, founded in 1923 and on the brink of failure, was sold at a fire sale price to J.P. Morgan in March of that year. Then in September, Lehman Brothers, whose origins dated back to about 1850, filed for the largest bankruptcy in U.S. history. Shortly thereafter, the U.S. government orchestrated an $85 billion bailout of American International Group, better known as AIG, the large multinational insurance company. The country faced its greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression. Many people have since asked whether these events were foreseeable, if not entirely preventable. Well, more than a year before its demise, Lehman Brothers' financial statements, specifically its balance sheets and statement of cash flows, clearly reflected the significant likelihood that the company would fail. As early as the spring of 2007, Lehman Brothers' liabilities and debt amounted to approximately 97% of the company's reported assets. 97%. That means that a mere 3% decline in the value of the company's assets would leave it with debt greater than the reported value of its assets. And to make things worse, much worse, the company's financial statements revealed that along with its extraordinary leverage, the company was generating negative cash flows from its operations, literally bleeding cash from its core business. Common sense tells you that if you are losing money and have debt amounting to 97% of your assets, you're in big trouble. At a minimum, the financial statements spoke loudly and clearly as to the company's need to recapitalize its finances, to reduce its debt, and strengthen its financial position. So if Lehman Brothers' financial statements from over a year preceding its failure clearly communicated the company's extraordinary financial risks – and significant possibility of failure. Where was the Securities and Exchange Commission? Where were the banking regulators? Why didn't the country's financial watchdogs notice the obvious accounting and financial red flags that a relatively quick glance at Lehman Brothers' financial statements would have revealed? And what about Wall Street's analysts? Sadly, the tragic stories of Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers echo the failure of Enron in 2001, which filed for bankruptcy after it was revealed that the company had engaged in an extensive and sustained accounting fraud. While the Enron accounting scandal did lead to wholesale changes in accounting rules and regulations, what was perhaps most shocking was the admission by the Securities and Exchange Commission that it had not reviewed any of Enron's post-1997 financial filings and only began to seriously investigate Enron's practices after the company's demise became all but inevitable. So what lessons should we take away from the Enron, Bear Stearns, and Lehman Brothers failures? I think one message is clear. It is our job to understand the accounting and financial reporting issues of the companies in which we are invested or in which we are considering making an investment. In this course, we are going to learn just those skills, to learn critical finance skills and how to read, interpret, and understand financial statements with the goal of making us better investors and business people. Accounting and finance make up a core part of any business curriculum, including every MBA program, because they are critical functional areas within any organization. And effective managers, business owners, and investors alike should be fluent in the accounting and finance lexicon. So what are accounting and finance exactly? Well, accounting is the language of business. It's an important means by which organizations communicate to key constituents in facts and figures how they are performing and how effectively they are fulfilling their strategic goals and objectives. Think about the key constituents within and external to any organization: employees, management, clients and customers, shareholders, lenders and creditors, members of the board of directors, and even the taxing authorities, Uncle Sam and its state and local equivalents. All of these constituents have a vested interest in the financial performance of organizations with which they are invested or involved. Employees, managers, and executives within an organization need to plan and control operations, manage resources, evaluate capital needs, and make important strategic decisions. Investors and creditors, including trade suppliers and lenders, need to decide whether to lend to or invest capital in organizations. They must evaluate the company's financial strength and performance, knowing that strong financial performance drives stock prices and portfolio returns. But how can these constituents make these decisions and evaluations? The answer, of course, is accounting data and the reports and financial statements that are generated from this accounting data. I like to say that accounting data and financial statements tell stories. That is, some people may look at financial statements and merely see a lot of numbers on pieces of paper. And that is certainly true. There are plenty of numbers on any financial statement you might review. But those numbers communicate a tremendous number of things about an organization. In fact, if you review the financial statements for any organization, you should be able to discern a tremendous amount about that entity within a few short minutes, including how profitable it is, how effectively the organization manages its assets, how it is funded, whether internally or externally, how cash inflows and outflows compare to the organization's reported profits or losses, whether the organization might require additional capital in the near future, and finally, whether the organization is at risk of failing. By the end of this course, you will be able to look at the financial statements for any organization and make the observations needed to answer these core questions. So that's a thumbnail sketch of accounting. Now, what about finance? Well, finance puts the language and the stories of accounting to practical use. Finance focuses on how accounting information is used to make certain decisions. These decisions might include whether a particular investment opportunity makes sense and should be pursued, how best to raise capital needed to run or expand operations, how to value stocks, bonds, or any cash flow producing investment like a rental property, or how to optimally select investments to place into a diversified portfolio. There's a lot of fascinating academic theory in the area of finance, which has very significant real-world and practical application. We will certainly be discussing these at length in the finance section of this course. But let's start our journey with accounting. And specifically, let's take a look today at the accounting disclosures and financial information that companies routinely prepare and provide to shareholders or owners. Our starting point is to get a copy of a company's most recent annual report. I'm sure many of you have seen these before, and if you have a number of investments already, you might find them routinely in your mailboxes, or even more likely these days, your inboxes. Companies are required to provide these annual reports to shareholders, and here in the United States, they file the equivalent, called a Form 10-K, with the Securities and Exchange Commission, generally within 60 to 75 days after the end of a company's fiscal year. So we generally see these trickle in around the end of February each year, with the majority released sometime each March. You can also find annual reports online, generally at company websites in the Investor Relations section. Just go to the website of the company you're interested in and let your fingers do the walking, or the mouse do the clicking, I suppose. And just so you know, many other organizations, including municipalities, nonprofits, and many private firms, also must prepare annual and audited financial statements. They may or may not be available online, depending on the circumstances. Okay, so you've got a company's annual report or Form 10-K in front of you. What next? What information do we actually find in these generally voluminous documents? Now, regardless of how they look, these annual reports must include several key things, including an overview of the company's business and operations, some discussion and analysis of financial results, financial statements and related footnotes, an independent audit report, and several other required disclosures. Obviously, there is a lot of information in here. For example, Time Warner's 2013 annual report is over 130 pages long, while IBM's is over 150. But let's focus on the key accounting information the company discloses. There are five financial statements disclosed in annual reports: the balance sheet, the income statement, the statement of cash flows, the statement of comprehensive income, and finally, the statement of shareholders' equity. An annual report is not complete without these five financial statements, and they can be found in every quarterly report as well. Now, to some of us, these statements may just look like lots of numbers and captions on a page. However, as I've said, these figures tell important stories, stories that help us answer key questions about organizations and their operations. So let's introduce the three most important statements, in my view: the balance sheet, income statement, and statement of cash flows, to understand what each is supposed to communicate to us. We will be discussing each in depth in upcoming lectures. The first financial statement that firms must provide is the balance sheet, often called the statement of financial position, which details what an organization owns, its assets, as well as what it owes, its liabilities and debts. All the information on the balance sheet is as of a particular point in time, typically the end of a fiscal quarter or year. If assets exceed liabilities, the difference is called shareholders' equity. If liabilities exceed assets, generally not a good thing, that would indicate a shareholder deficit. The balance sheet will help tell us how liquid an organization is, how much it has invested in working capital, things like inventory and accounts receivable, as well as how much debt the company has, and therefore how leveraged or risky it appears to be. Remember how I mentioned that Lehman Brothers' liabilities and debt equaled 97% of the company's total assets? That information could be quickly derived from the company's balance sheet, literally just dividing the company's liabilities and long-term debt by its total assets. The second financial statement is the income statement, often called the statement of operations, the profit and loss statement, or statement of revenues and expenses. It is probably the financial statement that gets the most attention from Wall Street and the media, since it includes such key metrics as revenues, net income, and earnings per share, which are widely cited and significantly impact stock prices. However, unlike the balance sheet, which is prepared as of a particular point in time, at the end of a particular quarter or fiscal year, the income statement reflects operations during a particular period of time. For example, the entire 3 months of a quarter or 12 months of a fiscal year. It starts with revenues, subtracts costs and expenses, and ends with net income or loss, or net surplus or deficit for nonprofit organizations. The income statement is the accountant's best effort at measuring the economic performance of an organization during a given period of time. At this point, I would like to make one very crucial point about the income statement to dispel a widely held misconception. While the income statement tells us about an organization's profit or loss, it does not tell us about an organization's actual cash flows. That is, we cannot look at an organization's income statement and discern whether the organization is actually generating or bleeding actual cash. Why not, you might ask? Well, publicly traded companies and most large organizations, public or private, must comply with generally accepted accounting principles, or GAAP for short. GAAP is the set of accounting rules primarily set forth by the Financial Accounting Standards Board, or FASB, the private sector body responsible for establishing accounting standards in the United States. Obviously, accounting rules are extensive and ever-evolving, reflecting the increasing complexity of our financial markets and the companies we invest in. In fact, I should note that there is no universal language, no Esperanto for accountants. Outside the U.S., most companies comply with international accounting standards, which are passed by the International Accounting Standards Board. Fortunately, the differences in rules between FASB and the IASB are fairly modest at present, though differences still exist, and it is unlikely, in my opinion, that we will ever have one universal accounting language. It would be terrific if that were achievable, if just so we could more easily compare and evaluate companies and investment opportunities from around the globe. In any event, one of the most critical rules of generally accepted accounting principles under both FASB and the IASB is that financial statements must be prepared using accrual accounting as opposed to cash-based accounting. Let's highlight this issue with a relatively simple example. If I were to ask each of you to estimate your household incomes so far this year, from January 1st through today, you would probably use a cash-based approach. You would look at your Quicken or Microsoft Money files if you use such a computer program to track your finances, or if not, you might look at your bank deposits, brokerage or investment statements, or credit card receipts. And through some addition and subtraction, you would come up with the net results, your estimated household income for the year. Now, most of us would stop there. We would not think to ourselves, wait a minute, it's the 17th of the month or whatever day it happens to be, and compute how much salary or other income we have earned up to this point but have not yet received in cash to determine our household income. Similarly, we probably would not think about the six-month insurance premium we paid just last month and ask ourselves whether we should allocate that expense over time, the 6 months to which the premium relates. Or if we are paid monthly, we would not try and estimate how much salary we have earned this month but are still owed. Well, maybe you wouldn't do this sort of calculus for our own households, but that's exactly the way organizations must estimate income, actually allocating income and expenses on specific dates. Welcome to accrual accounting, which is required for publicly traded firms under generally accepted accounting principles. So for example, imagine you work for Cisco and you sell $30 million worth of computer networking equipment to a large corporate customer. Now this customer doesn't have all the cash on hand, so Cisco decides to provide financing, allowing the customer to pay the amount they owe over a period of, say, 2 to 3 years. Under the rules of accrual accounting, that long-term financing plan doesn't prevent Cisco from recognizing revenue for the sold equipment. As soon as Cisco delivers the equipment to the customer, the company will recognize revenue from the sale, even though the actual cash from the sale may not be received for quite some time. Here's another example that highlights the difference between cash and accrual accounting. Imagine you are a member of Costco, Sam's Club, or BJ's Wholesale, big box retailers that require you to purchase an annual membership in order to shop there. I imagine this is more than just a hypothetical for many of us. I myself am an executive member of Costco, and I'm just proud to be an executive member of something. Anyway, how should these companies account for the annual membership revenue that they receive up front in cash? Well, accounting rules require that they recognize the revenue in their profit and loss statements on a pro rata basis each and every month, even though they collect the cash up front. So if the annual membership fees were $120, the company would recognize $10 in revenue each month, because it has to recognize the revenue over the period during which it is actually earned. In this case, each month of the one-year membership period. Now, the differences may seem trivial, but the net results are very important. This is because any firm complying with generally accepted accounting principles will have reported profits or losses on their income statement that differ from cash flows, and the differences can be very material. We will see some examples of this in upcoming lectures, and we'll also discuss how significant this might be for making investment decisions. As a result, organizations must provide us with a third financial statement that we're introducing today, the statement of cash flows. This statement reports, for a certain period of time, the amount of actual cash either generated or consumed by an organization. That is, did the organization actually increase its cash balance during a particular period or not? As we will discuss, the statement of cash flows provides two key pieces of data for users of financial statements. First, it lays out the differences between reported profits or losses under accrual accounting and the actual cash inflows or outflows of the organization during that same period. Second, it segments the cash flows into three distinct but logical buckets: cash flow from operating activities, cash flows from investing activities, and cash flows from financing activities. Operating activities are supposed to reflect the cash inflows or outflows from day-to-day normal and recurring operations. Investing activities should capture the cash inflows or outflows from a company making non-recurring investment decisions, which include the purchase of property, plant, or equipment, mergers and acquisitions, or even the investment of excess cash into stocks and bonds. And finally, financing activities should reflect cash inflows and outflows from transactions involving a company's lenders and shareholders, such as the issuance of stock or bonds, the payment of dividends, or the repurchase of company stock. The statement of cash flows is extremely important, as it tends to be the most objective of the financial statements, since cash is cash and harder to fudge. That is, the amount of cash an organization has at any point in time, and therefore the change in cash from one period to the next, is relatively easy to verify. But perhaps even more importantly, the statement of cash flows will serve as a crucial link to valuation when we discuss how to actually value stocks later in this course. Now that we have introduced the three financial statements we will be discussing in greater detail in upcoming lectures, I would like to dispel some myths about accounting that are extremely important to keep in mind. The first is that accounting is black and white. Perhaps people believe that because accounting involves so many numbers and figures and is rules-based, it must be scientific and objective. Unfortunately, this just isn't the case. First, there are a number of estimates that pervade the financial statements, and there is plenty of judgment and subjectivity involved in application of particular accounting rules. They might include estimates as to how much of the company's receivables owed by customers are not going to be collected, or how many products sold are going to be returned or require warranty repairs because they're defective. Or over what period of time should a company depreciate a piece of equipment that was recently acquired? By definition, estimates are inexact. But as we'll see again and again during this course, estimates are an essential component of accounting and financial reporting. And this brings us to the second accounting myth I would like to dispel. People often assume that there must be one important figure that investors or others should look at to evaluate financial performance, whether that figure is revenues, net income, earnings per share, or something else. In fact, the most common question my accounting students ask is, what's the most important metric that they should look at within the financial statements? Wouldn't it be great if there were a single figure we all could look at within a company's financial statements to surmise how well or poorly they are performing, or how risky they might be? Unfortunately, there is no answer to my students' question. That is, there is no one single measure, one silver bullet we can look at in the sea of financial information to assess financial performance. While some metrics or disclosures might be more important than others, it is crucial that we take a holistic approach to analyzing and reviewing financial statements. The third myth regarding accounting is that companies should have only one set of accounting records. Having more than one set of books might sound like fraud, but in fact is actually business as usual. For example, most organizations have at least two sets of accounting records, one for creditors, lenders, and shareholders, and the other for Uncle Sam or the tax authorities. Now, you might think that the rules as to how transactions are reported to shareholders would be the same as to how they are reported in tax returns, but that is far from the truth. For example, wouldn't it be great if firms could report one set of profits to shareholders and another, much lower, to the tax authorities, sort of the accounting version of having your cake and eating it too? Well, I have some good news. That is not only possible, but absolutely happens. Perhaps this is not surprising, since the tax authorities and the accounting regulators may not have identical objectives. For example, Uncle Sam usually wants to promote investments in things like research and development or capital assets, and may allow special or additional deductions to firms making such investments. So some differences are expected, but the differences are often significant and not always intuitive. For example, take Apple, the manufacturer of iPhones and iPads. If your house is anything like mine, you likely have one or more Apple products lying around. Anyhow, for 2013, Apple reported pre-tax earnings of $50.2 billion to shareholders. That's right, over $50 billion with a B of pre-tax earnings. Not revenues, but earnings. That is one of the largest pre-tax profits ever reported in U.S. history. On that level of earnings, Apple reported $13.1 billion in income tax expense, but actually paid $9.1 billion in taxes. That sounds like a lot, and it is, but it only represents some 18% of pre-tax profits, far lower than the top federal tax rate in the U.S. of 35%. Apple is obviously taking advantage of various tax loopholes and rules to avoid paying taxes. There is absolutely nothing inherently illegal or improper about that. And in fact, Apple CEO Timothy Cook has testified before Congress on this issue and merely stated that the company was complying with tax laws and taking advantage of the rules as written. The important thing for us to keep in mind is that the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the Internal Revenue Service often do not see eye to eye. Finally, the last myth or misconception regarding accounting I want to dispel is the idea that the financial statements tell us how much a company or organization is actually worth. This is definitely inaccurate. For example, the balance sheet may indicate what a firm owns and owes, but as we will discuss, most assets are not reported at their fair market values. And in fact, some very valuable assets might be omitted from the balance sheet entirely. This includes many intangible assets like patents, trademarks, or copyrights. For example, take the value of the Apple logo, the Coca-Cola brand name, or Mickey Mouse, obviously three of the most valuable intangible assets in the world, each worth billions of dollars. Obviously, their owners generate significant profits and cash flows from them. However, guess how much each is valued on Apple, Coke, and Disney's balance sheets, respectively? Zero. Despite their tremendous value, accountants do not record these assets on the financial statements. Why not, you might ask? The question is, how would one value these assets exactly? They are obviously worth billions of dollars, but without truly objective means of valuing these intangible assets, accountants have decided not to record them on the financial statements at all. Thus, to estimate the value of a company, we will need to take the accounting information we do have, and then we'll have to make appropriate assumptions and adjustments, since we cannot read everything directly from the balance sheet. We will be addressing firm valuation in the finance section of this course. So this wraps up our introduction to accounting and finance. Let's summarize the key takeaways from this lecture. 1. Companies complying with generally accepted accounting principles must prepare 5 key financial statements: balance sheet, income statement, statement of cash flows, statement of comprehensive income, and the statement of shareholders' equity. 2. GAAP requires the use of accrual accounting, so reported profits are not equal to actual firm cash flows. 3. Because the application of GAAP requires significant judgment and lots of subjectivity, we need to closely examine and evaluate the financial statements of any organization we may be interested in. And finally, the financial statements provide important clues and critical data to help us value companies, but do not directly provide or disclose those values. Looking back, there is no question that a close inspection of the financial statements of Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and the other large companies that failed during the last financial crisis would have revealed just how risky these institutions had become. And perhaps their failures and the crisis itself might have been prevented. As we move forward, we'll explore even more of the really interesting and informative analyses we can perform by applying some fundamental lessons in accounting and finance, with the goal of improving our financial decision-making in business and in life. Until next time, we will take a deeper dive into the all-important balance sheet. Thank you for your time.
This lecture is titled, How to Interpret a Balance Sheet.
In our last lecture, we introduced some key concepts in accounting and finance and explained why they are two of the cornerstones in any MBA curriculum and critically important topics that all investors and business people should understand. Today, we will take a deeper dive into the balance sheet, one of the 5 financial statements that firms complying with generally accepted accounting principles must provide to shareholders, in addition to the income statement, statement of cash flows, statement of comprehensive income, and statement of shareholders' equity. You will recall that the balance sheet is the financial statement that details what an organization owns, its assets, and what it owes, its liabilities, all as of a particular point in time, typically the end of a quarter or year. Most public companies' fiscal years match the calendar year, and thus they prepare and disclose balance sheets as of the end of March, June, September, and of course December. To the extent that assets on the balance sheet exceed liabilities, the difference represents shareholders' equity, a positive figure. To the extent the opposite is true, where liabilities exceed assets, you would have a shareholder deficit. The balance sheet is particularly important because it provides clues about an organization's financial stability, its risk, and its liquidity, its ability to meet its shorter and longer-term financial obligations. And we all know what can happen when organizations are no longer able to pay their debts. Look no further than General Motors, Eastman Kodak, or even the city of Detroit, all of which filed for bankruptcy and have had to significantly reorganize their finances and operations just to remain in business. Other firms like Lehman Brothers and Circuit City were unable to survive in their previous form and liquidated simply because they had excessive amounts of debt and were unable to meet their financial obligations. The balance sheet is the financial statement that provides a window into the likelihood that an organization may become insolvent. One other macro-level point is that balance sheets are an important financial statement for all organizations, from the smallest startup to the Walmarts and Exxons of the world, to your local city government, to the federal government itself. And even individual households should have a sense as to what their assets and debts are in order to optimally manage their finances, invest appropriately, and plan for the future. Let's consider the balance sheet of a company you are likely familiar with, Intel, the manufacturer of microprocessors, chips, and other products used in various technology applications. Now, Intel's balance sheet, along with all of their other financial statements, can be found very easily on the company's website in the investor relations area. It is included in the company's financial filings, its quarterly and annual reports filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission. So what we're going to do is walk through Intel's consolidated balance sheet from their 2013 annual report. It is consolidated, meaning it combines all of the company's operations from around the world. Let's start out with a few high-level observations. First, take Intel's 2013 balance sheet. As is standard protocol, there are two reporting periods presented, the end of December 13 and 2012. This is typical for all organizations and obviously lets us compare numbers over time between two reporting periods. Organizations typically provide balance sheet figures as of the end of the most recent reporting period, usually the end of a calendar quarter or fiscal year, along with balances from the end of the prior fiscal year, in this case, 2012. The second thing worth noting is that all of the balances on the Intel balance sheet are in millions. Obviously, Intel is a large company, so they disclose their financial statement figures in millions. A smaller firm might do so in thousands. The U.S. government might disclose their balances in trillions. It is important just to keep this in mind as we look in greater detail at the financial statement figures. The third thing you'll notice when you look at the balance sheet is this. Assets are listed first, and then